Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with all but three Democratic senators pulling the trigger on the so-called nuclear option in a 52-48 vote to pass executive branch and judicial nominees by a simple majority vote, after the persistent use of the filibuster by the Republicans that has all but paralyzed the Senate. Michelle Schwartz, the Director of Justice Programs at the Alliance for Justice, joins us to discuss this dramatic change in Senate rules and its likely consequences. Then on the 50th anniversary of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy, we will speak with Senator Gary Hart, who served on the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence Agencies, known as the Church Committee, that investigated CIA, Cuban, and Mafia ties to the assassination. We'll examine important leads that Senator Hart feels the press should have picked up on and followed that to this day remain largely unexamined, since one of the two main mafia witnesses the committee investigated was killed shortly after testifying and the second was murdered shortly before testifying. Then finally, we will speak with the first person to deliver the first eyewitness account of President Kennedy's assassination, Julian Reed, who at the time was Texas Governor John Connally's representative to the national media for President Kennedy's visit to Texas in November of 1963. He joins us to discuss what he saw and experienced on that tragic day as the first person to arrive at Parkland Hospital to find Jackie Kennedy and Nellie Connally standing alone outside trauma rooms 1 and 2, waiting to hear the fate of their husbands inside, who had both been shot. And joining us now is Michelle Schwartz, who is the Director of Justice Programs at the Alliance for Justice. She previously served for 6 years as a senior staff member for Senator Frank Lautenberg as his Deputy Chief of Staff and Legislative Director. She began her time with Senator Lautenberg as senior counsel working on judiciary, telecommunications, and labor issues, and throughout her tenure in the office maintained a focus on judicial nominations, gun violence prevention, and media access. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michelle Schwartz.
Thank you, Ian. It's a pleasure to be with you.
And Michelle, today the Democrats in the Senate pulled the trigger on the so-called nuclear option. Apparently, Senator Harry Reid, it's pretty clear that he's resisted this for a long time, but the level of frustration got so great. And I think a lot of pressure from the younger Democratic senators pushed him over the top. I noticed that Senator Carl Levin and two Democrats from Republican-leaning states voted with the minority, with the Republicans. But let's start with the assumption that Harry Reid just was fed up. Is that your understanding?
I think that Harry Reid was fed up and that he wasn't the only one. And it's true that champions who are some of the newer senators, like Jeff Merkley from Oregon and Tom Udall from New Mexico, were really pushing for this. But so is Tom Harkin, who's one of the lions of the Senate. And what you saw this time around, which we had never seen before, was that you had Senator Leahy, Pat Leahy of Vermont, the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, who was so fed up with what was happening to judicial nominees that really for the first time ever he said, you know what, we've got to change the rules. Similarly, you had Senators Boxer and Feinstein from California, who in the past have expressed some skepticism about changing the rules, and they too were so fed up, especially with on the D.C. Circuit, that there were two women who were being held up, and they were actually on top of another woman who had been filibustered earlier in the year. And so they were really fed up, and they had come out publicly and said, you know what, we've got to look at changing the rules. So that's what was really different this time around, is yes, you had these champions who had been doing this all along, and then you also really had some of the, you know, old hands in the Senate saying, we cannot stand for this anymore.
And this vote of 52-48 to change the Senate rules only applies to federal judge nominees and executive office appointments that can now be confirmed by a simple majority of senators, but the change does not apply to Supreme Court nominations. Although,
That's right. Although
Mitch McConnell, the minority leader of the Senate, who accused the Democrats of a power grab and said that they will regret their decision, particularly when Republicans regain control of the chamber, he doesn't believe that's the case. I mean, he believes it leaves the Republicans open to apply this to Supreme Court nominees as well. How can that distinction be maintained with this rule change? Do you know anything about these arcane rules? Because I think a lot of Americans confuse the U.S. Constitution with Senate rules, and they think that somehow the filibuster is in the Constitution, which it's not.
That's right. The filibuster is certainly not in the U.S. Constitution, and some would say it's kind of an accident of history. But the change that was sought today and that was made today was on, as you say, Ian, lower court nominees, so the nominees to the circuit courts of appeals across the country, the district courts all across the country, and to executive branch nominees. It is not a change for the Supreme Court. As you say, there have been some in the Republican Party, including Mitch McConnell, who have said, well, once you do this, you can't stop it for the Supreme Court. The fact of the matter is that over the years, I mean, the Republicans have really gotten the people who they want on the Supreme Court. I think, you know, one of the most outrageous statements that was made in recent days was, well, if the Democrats go ahead and do this, then they're going to see, you know, they're going to see more Thomases and Scalias and Alitos on the Supreme Court. Well, they're already on the Supreme Court, and none of them were filibustered. They were all put on the Supreme Court by simple majority votes.
So, and one of the characteristics of this majority of conservative justices on all of the federal courts, including the Supreme Court, has been so many of them come from the Federalist Society. Is there any equivalent on the left in this country to the Federalist Society? Because they seem to be extremely effective.
Well, and, you know, I should note that last week the Federalist Society had their big annual black tie fundraising gala in Washington, D.C., and that the headliner for that big fundraising gala was none other than Justice Clarence Thomas. And that's something that at Alliance for Justice we have been pushing to subject the Supreme Court to a code of ethics, which they're not currently subject to any code of ethics. If they were, that's something that would be prohibited. And, you know, it's very disconcerting to see this cozy relationship between Supreme Court justices and the Federalist Society, and where they're even going and raising money for the Federalist Society. You know, on our side, I would not say that there's an equivalent, but there is always an effort to identify people and identify judges, and this is a lot of what we do at Alliance for Justice, is to identify candidates who are going to really reflect the values of everyday people and are going to be responsive to those concerns and to the problems that are occurring in most Americans' lives. And so that's something that we have always been focused on, and there are other groups doing that as well.
Again, I'm speaking with Michelle Schwartz, who's the Director of Justice Programs at the Alliance for Justice. She previously served for 6 years as a senior staff member for Senator Frank Lautenberg as his Deputy Chief of Staff and Legislative Director. She began her time with Senator Lautenberg as senior counsel, working on judiciary, telecommunications, and labor issues, and throughout her tenure in the office maintained a focus on judicial nominations, gun violence prevention, and media access. So, given that Senator Levin voted with the Republicans, and he's very much a kind of liberal line of the Senate, the other two Democrats, Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Mark Pryor of Arkansas, presumably voted because they were concerned about being in Republican-leaning states. But in terms of what Levin had to say, he said that he railed against the GOP for its obstruction of Obama's nominee, saying they're being irresponsible and this has been partisan gamesmanship and that the Republicans are contributing to the destruction of an important check against majority overreach. But he said, but by changing the rules, there are no rules anymore. Today, quoting him, today we are once again moving down a destructive path. So what is he warning about here?
Well, and Senator Levin, it was no surprise that he did not vote with the vast majority of the Democratic caucus today. He has been clear all along about where he stands on the rules, and that's his position, and, you know, that's fine. And so I think that, you know, he is looking towards a past in the Senate, but unfortunately, I think that it's trying to hold on to something that just doesn't exist anymore, and that at a time when the filibuster was used sparingly, that's totally different. But today, that's just not the case. And the filibusters have become just different in kind from where they were before. So in the past, filibusters, especially on nominations, were used when there were concerns about a specific individual and their qualifications for office. But today, they're just being used to, as the president said earlier today, just gum up the works. And it's really been an attempt to nullify what this president is trying to do and to nullify, actually, the results of the past two elections. And so I think, you know, I also, as you mentioned, worked for a senator who had been in the Senate since the early 1980s, and he came out in a different place than Senator Levin did and really felt that things had gotten to a very bad point and, you know, was looking at filibuster reform, and he wasn't there to vote today, unfortunately. But, you know, as I said before, Senator Tom Harkin, who has been in the Senate for a very long time, it has been one of the leaders on changing the rules. And Senator Leahy, who was sitting in the chair today because he is the president pro tem of the Senate, which by definition means that he is the longest serving senator, he got to a point where he said, you know what, we've got to change these rules. And we have been working for having a talking filibuster on legislation so that, you know, so that filibusters look the way that people think that they look, so that they look like they did when Mr. Smith went to Washington or when Wendy Davis took to the floor of the Texas State Senate this summer. And that's just not the way that filibusters are these days, that generally nobody gets up and speaks. And so that's what we've really been working for on legislation, not necessarily changing the vote threshold. That's not what we've been working on specifically, but we have been really working for other reforms to make sure that these aren't just silent filibusters. These aren't something that somebody's calling in from their office or even from a restaurant on K Street, that they're actually in, that they're actually down on the floor having to filibuster. And so that the filibuster means debate, that it doesn't just mean that you're obstructing for obstruction's sake.
So is that something that you think can be worked on and ratified in a way? Because one of the criticisms I've had of the framing of this debate over the abuse of the filibuster has been the Democrats' use of the word nuclear option, which implies some Armageddon, some catastrophic and cataclysmic decision, when in fact it looks as if you're just going back to the way the business has always been done in the Senate. The point that you're making about the filibuster requiring senators to actually have some skin in the game, as in that movie, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, what are the chances of doing that? Because Senator Rand Paul did do a real filibuster fairly recently, and then Senator Ted Cruz sort of did a faux filibuster, largely exactly. Grandstanding to raise funds and raise his profile to run in 2016. But if you look at what Cruz just did, you know, it could be a free-for-all, couldn't it?
Well, I think that there is an appetite for having a real talking filibuster, and that's something that we're going to continue working towards. And right now, any senator could go to the floor and actually filibuster and actually speak. The one thing that today's vote didn't change is that there are time requirements. So every time that you have a filibuster, you are having hours and hours of time in the Senate that have to elapse before votes can be held. And so during those periods of time, any senator could go to the floor and speak. They just don't. So they're objecting, and yet for 30 hours, nobody's on the floor. And you turn on C-SPAN, too, and you see that there's just silence on the floor and nobody there, and they're playing you know, elevator music for people who are watching it on TV. So right now, people could be going to the floor and talking about it, but they're not. And so, as you said, they're not forced to have any skin in the game, and that's something that we think is important that they do. And on your first point about that this isn't really the nuclear option, this is just returning to regular order, that is absolutely right. This is the way that the Senate has functioned historically, that you consider nominations in as part of the regular business of the Senate, and things have just gone in way out of control under this president, and the Senate has engaged in unprecedented obstruction, and all that today's move is doing is bringing things back to normal.
So, Michelle Schwartz, what's likely to happen? Where you've got, you know, Mitch McConnell and the Republicans saying this is a power grab, and they're going to take to the airwaves and suggest that this is something really undemocratic has just happened, as opposed to returning to business as normal. What's the next step for the Democrats, though? Are they going to try and fill this backlog in the judiciary? It's considerable. I mean, they could be putting through, what, God knows how many nominees. You know, are they going to fast-track them and just get them all through and get them all done?
That is what needs to happen now. So the first thing that needs to happen is that all three nominees for the D.C. Circuit, who are all supremely qualified, they need to be confirmed right away. They are on their way, and that needs to happen. Mel Watt, who is nominated for the Federal Housing Finance Administration and has been filibustered, he needs to be confirmed right away. There are 53 pending judicial nominees currently. They all need to get confirmed right away. And then on top of that, there are 57 vacancies without nominees, and the president needs to go ahead, nominate people for every single open seat.
On the judiciary, that's both in terms
of the judiciary.
In district courts and higher courts, is that?
Yes, it's all district courts and circuit courts of appeals. So there are 57 without nominees, and there are 53 with nominees. So we've got a total of 110 judicial vacancies, and we've got to fill every single one of those without delay.
So this points to the disparity here, right? Isn't the judiciary fairly slanted now in a conservative direction with, we mentioned the domination of the Federalist Society? What is the current balance on the court from Democratic nominees? By the way, when you talk about balance, you know, the goalposts have already been moved in terms of the selection process in itself because of Republican filibusters and obstruction. Most of the nominees, my understanding is that both President Clinton and President Obama put forth have been uncontroversial, and they tend to be centrists. You know, we keep talking about liberals, the divide between the liberals and conservatives on the Supreme Court. To me, that's a complete misnomer. I don't believe there are any liberals, with perhaps one exception, on the Supreme Court in the tradition of Justice Thurgood Marshall and William O. Douglas and others. They're more centrists. And then on the right, you've got the four or five arch conservatives. But has that what's happened here, that the whole center of gravity has moved just way to the right?
Well, I think I would urge your listeners to take a look. We have detailed reports on the judiciary and the state of the judiciary on our website, which is www.afj.org. And you're right that that President Obama, President Clinton, they routinely look to nominating very mainstream candidates for the bench, and they're not putting on people who or far left, and that's in stark contrast to Republican nominees who are on the bench today. And you've got Reagan appointees who are still on the bench today exerting significant influence over the shape of our laws in our country, and from the both Bush presidencies as well. And they are much further to the right than the Democratic appointees are to the left. And we see that, as you said, on the Supreme Court as well. And when you look at, for example, the D.C. Circuit, which is the court that brought all of these issues to a head because of the filibuster of three unquestionably qualified nominees for that court, 15 out of the last 19 judges to be put on that court were put there by Republican presidents. And so you have a court that is, by all accounts, the second most important court in the land, because it reaches decisions that really touch on all Americans on a wide range of issues, from the environment to public health to safety to workers' rights. And that's a court that's just been dominated for years and years by far-right appointees.
Well, Michelle Schwartz, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian. It's really been a pleasure.
Likewise. Again, I've been speaking with Michelle Schwartz, who is the Director of Justice Programs at the Alliance for Justice. She previously served for 6 years as a senior staff member for Senator Frank Lautenberg as his Deputy Chief of Staff and Legislative Director. She began her time with Senator Lautenberg as senior counsel working on judiciary, telecommunications, and labor issues, and throughout her tenure in his office, maintained a focus on judicial nominations, gun violence prevention, and media access. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with Senator Gary Hart about the investigation he and his committee did into the Cuban mafia and CIA connections to the assassination of President Kennedy.